Driving back from Heathrow, Ronnie and Tessa had gone out of their way to stop at the nearest motorway service station. There they'd used a passport photograph booth to have pictures taken. Ronnie now handed the prints to Josh and told him what he wanted, spreading out a couple of sheets of plain paper covered with his neat handwriting. I want these back when it's done, mind. The grin did a fast fade from the Dormouse's face. Don't want much, do you? It'll cost. How much? 4 grand. Used notes, same as ever. 5, if I can have it by 7 tonight. Done. Off now. You've got it. After a short exchange of questions and answers concerning the work, Richardson left, hailing a cab in Piccadilly Circus and travelling through the bottleneck of Kensington Gore back to the Royal Garden. That evening, he returned to the ironmonger's to collect a small package, which he showed to Tessa after they'd dined well in the garden room at the penthouse restaurant at the hotel. Over coffee in their suite, Ronnie explained exactly how he intended to kill President and Madame Bortounin. When he finished the explanation, he went through it again, emphasizing the part Tessa was to play in the plan. He then went through it a third time, after which he asked questions. Things fell into place for Tessa. Over the past 2 days she had, on Ronnie's instructions, bought certain items and played certain roles. Now she knew why. After Tessa had asked a couple of questions, Ronnie unlocked his briefcase and handed her a Browning 9mm automatic. Years ago he had taught her to shoot, and was confident that she could use the weapon if it became necessary. "You're in up to your armpits now, Tess," he told her. "Let's do it properly, and if anything goes wrong, then don't get taken alive." Somehow it did not sound melodramatic the way he said it. Finally he went through the plan one more time for luck, though he'd left little to luck. The man known as Josh was the world champion of forged documents, a grand master in the production of fake letters, IDs, and the like. In a profession now badly damaged by cheap and cheerful computer work, Josh performed what he thought of as a quality service for the high end of the trade. Over the past days in London, Ronnie had made innumerable telephone calls, fitting himself out with everything else he required to do a professional job. Now he was armed with facts, names, places, times, and passwords. He knew, for instance, exactly where the car that would take President and Madame Bortounin from Heathrow safely into central London was garaged. He knew the name of the driver, and what his movements would be, and with whom he would be in contact. More particularly, Ronnie knew exactly when the driver would pick up the car, and who else should be at the pick-up point in West London. Knowing all this, Ronnie planned to be by the sleek, armoured official rover long before anyone else. Kit Palfrey travelled back to Glasgow with Bex, Charlie and Patsy in the big Chinook, carrying on a shouted conversation with Charlie. Flying in a Chinook is not the same as whizzing from Heathrow to Kennedy in a 747. "I always say you've never flown till you've bucked around in a military chopper," Kit said loudly into Charlie's ear. Around them, the noise seemed almost tangible. "What are you going to do now, then, Kit?" Charlie was interested. He wondered if the government would ever admit to Kit's double life during the Cold War. "Live quietly in Portugal, singing fados to the moon." It was a half-remembered line from some unmemorable poem. Charlie recalled spending a couple of weeks in Lisbon, eating cake and drinking too much wine, while he ran an intelligence informer through a gymkhana of simple questions, none of which had much of an answer. In the evenings, he used to go down to a cafe inside of the sea and listen to melancholy fados being sung to the accompaniment of a competent guitarist. The singer was a young girl from a village near Vigo. She singled out Charlie, and when she found that he was English, she became his lover to improve her language skills. He smiled at the thought of how she would breathlessly gasp, "Yes, Charlie, yes, I came." She was wonderfully young, with all the sexual inventiveness of an original, and Charlie thought back with fondness to a time when his life seemed endlessly uncomplicated. He could see her clearly, the mole on her left breast, and the dark golden aureoli around her nipples. He heard her laugh, saw her smile, and vividly felt her sexual tightness on the business side of her trimmed, cropped bush. But for the life of him, he could not remember her name. He was ashamed of himself. When they got to Glasgow, Kit disappeared. There one minute, then, with a grin and a wave, he walked off and vanished. Charlie never saw him again. They had a 2-hour wait for a flight to Heathrow, so Charlie wanted to drag Bex off to the Glasgow Road Infirmary to see Hillary. But Patsy was not having any of it. Joe Ben will have my guts for the proverbial if I don't actually bring her right back to his door. Patsy took it all very seriously, so in the end Charlie went off by himself. To his surprise, Hillary was sitting up, chatting away to the P.O. who had saved her life. Charlie joined in, but felt left out completely. When Pete Brooks went off in search of a bathroom, Hillary, bubbling with excitement, told Charlie that he was leaving his wife. "She's run him ragged, Charlie. Isn't it amazing? If someone hadn't tried to kill me, I might never have met him." Her excitement was infectious, and Charlie went back to the airport awash with good humour. "Hey, Bex," he whispered, as they flew to London at 25,000 feet. "I got a nice surprise for you tonight."
"Animal, vegetable, or mineral?"
"All animal."
"You dirty beast, Charlie,"
she giggled. In the hold of Tsar Ivan IV, the man was screaming. He tried to thrash around, kicking and struggling, shouting in terror. "Please," he shrieked, "please, for God's sake, I've told you. I've accounted for every penny. What good will this? I'm sorry, I've given you everything." "It's not yours to give, Colin. You ask me, what good will it do?" Chomiet spoke far more English than he had owned to in the whores flat off Praed Street with Jimmy McLean. "What could this do, Father fucking Benedict? I'll tell you exactly what good it'll do. It'll be an object lesson, a discipline. It'll be a visual aid. You British use a French expression, pour encourager les autres, to encourage the others. That's what it'll do. It'll encourage the others never to steal money, goods, people, or things that belong to me and my family. It will tell people not to screw around with my family." Vitus and Lapsy held Nitus's left arm against the crossbar, while Chermiet raised the mallet and brought its heavy, flat end down on Colin Knight's hand, smashing at bone and tissue. He screamed again, then again, as this time Chermiet held the sharp-pointed wooden stake and drove it right through Knight's crushed left palm. The stake crushed through flesh and bones, causing unbelievable pain. It was like white-hot lances being held to the flesh, and the pain jumped and stitched itself up his arm. His brain became totally inarticulate when the second stake went in, and the ropes were bound around his outstretched arms. He could not believe how his body altered at the horror that engulfed him. They broke his feet, then drove stakes through them, smashing bone once more, so that a great humming wall of agony engulfed him from his demolished extremities. They tied him to the cross, then lifted and hauled it up, lodging it against the metal side of the hold, steadying it with guy ropes threaded through metal eyes let into the deck. Knight had no idea how they managed to keep the cross upright, for he did not think he could imagine further pain, until he was hanging from the cross, pinioned to it, outstretched, with his muscles and sinews joining in the clamour that was a river of flaming agony. He wanted to die. He screamed until his voice box dried up and he could scream no more. Chermiet shouted up at the racked body, "Steal from me and die like Christ." He then muttered to his two henchmen, "Throw the whole thing over the side. When you're in the channel, the English channel, throw it all into the sea so that the British will know what we do with those who betray us." The men, Vitus and Lapsy, were the kind of people who reacted well to melodrama. Chermiet knew this, as indeed he knew a lot of things.
Colin Knight took hours to die, and every moment of his dying was anguish. And before he died, his sphincter muscles loosened, and his bowels gave way, and the human waste flooded down the wood, mixing with the blood. It is what happens when you crucify someone. That's how it is. At 10:30 that evening, as they passed close to the Welsh coast, between Swansea and Porthcawl, the inflatable was run out again, and Chermet climbed down the net. This time the freighter's captain accompanied him. Chermet was not going to have any mistakes. He knew little about the sea and questioned almost everything people told him. The captain had said he would be able to pinpoint a small stretch of beach and land his leader on it. The beach had been chosen before Tsar Ivan IV had left her port in Russia. Nothing to it, the captain had told Chermet. If there was nothing to it, Chermet said, then the captain should also put his freedom at risk. The little inflatable was low in the water, and the small stretch of coast did not come within the range of any shore-based radar. It took an hour to bring the craft close into the shore. When they were almost on the beach, the captain aimed a flashlight toward the beach and winked a series of long and short flashes. They waited, the engine cut to idle, until flashes answered from shore. The captain whispered good luck to Chermet. Seconds later, the stocky little figure was gone, swallowed up by the night. In a few hours, he would be in London, certainly in time for the arrival of the President of the Russian Federation.